So Joseph's life divides up quite neatly into three. The first 17 years of his life you could call the years of obscurity. So he's just learning to be a shepherd. He's moving house a couple of times. His mother dies prematurely. Just, we don't know much about him. We'll call that years of obscurity. Then from 17 through to 30, those were years of adversity. So there are three P's connected with those years: the pit, Potiphar's house, and the prison. A terrible time in his life, years of adversity. And then from 30 to 110 when he died, years of prosperity. He becomes the Lord of Egypt. His brethren come down and reunite with him. His father comes down and spends the last 17 years of his life in Egypt. Now, if you were God and you were organizing a person's life, would you do it that way? Would you have obscurity, adversity, and prosperity? I think 13 years of adversity in the bloom of youth must have been incredibly difficult for Joseph. We expect adversity as we get older and we have families and we get ill. But age 17 to 30 was an incredibly difficult time for him. He went through unspeakable experiences of cruelty, unfairness, false accusation, and not from strangers, from his own brothers. It was just heartlessly mean, and they were mercilessly deceptive about the whole thing. They lied to their father and so on. And it was all envy. It was just sheer jealousy and envy. It wasn't that Joseph did anything wrong. And wave after wave of disappointment and disaster just swept over his life. So instead of being glad to see him at Dothan, his brothers sold him as a slave. So he goes down into Egypt and he does his best for Potiphar, and he gets falsely accused by Potiphar's wife and thrown into jail. And then he gets into jail and he does his best in jail and the butler forgets him. And it just seems like, when is this tidal wave of bad stuff ever going to stop? And the amazing thing is, in the face of all of that, you never get any complaints from Joseph. You never get seemingly any bitterness. We know from later in his life, he was totally reconciled to the whole thing. He wasn't bitter. He wasn't even in despair. I mean, you'd have thought at some point from 17 to 30, he would have said, what is the point of this believing in God business? And it's just like, you know, today there's a lot of talk of, have you ever been angry against God? Well, maybe that's a thing. But Joseph never seemed to get to that point. He never ever made an attempt to get even. He never even saw himself as a victim. We live in a day of victimhood, of victim mentality. Everybody's a victim. So he was externally enslaved, but he was never internally enslaved. You say, well, how can you be internally enslaved? Well, you can be internally enslaved if you give way to victimhood and self-pity. Bitterness is a funny old thing. Bitterness, it feels good. You know, when you're angry with someone and you're bitter against them and you can't, you know, if you hear something bad's happened to them, there's a certain thing about bitterness that feels good, but it's not actually good for you. Bitterness is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. That's what bitterness will do for you. It'll turn you into a worse person than the person you're bitter against. You see, it's very easy to see all the faults of others. That person's a hypocrite. That person's hasn't got a godly bone in their body. That person said something really cruel about her. I found out that she's gossiping about me. And but then when you respond with just endless bitterness and endless, I'm not going to shake hands with them, I'm not going to, you know, and you just, you've actually got, you see, we're all responsible to the Lord. They've done what they've done, okay. But we're now responsible for what we do back. I'm not responsible for what they've done to me. But I am responsible for what I do back or what I don't do back. And Joseph learned that lesson. So he was imprisoned physically. But the wonderful thing is he was free spiritually. Some of you may remember a book many years ago called Tortured for Christ by Richard Wurmbrand. Richard Wurmbrand was a pastor in Romania, and during the Cold War, which was the time in history when Russia and the West were at loggerheads, and there was a curtain that sort of went down, not a physical curtain, but there was a line went down through Europe. That side was communist, this side was the West, capitalist, whatever. And on that side of the curtain, on the Russian side, you weren't allowed to read the Bible. You weren't. God was banished from society. And anybody that met as a church, even if they're underground, they could be just put in prison and tortured. So this pastor was tortured. He eventually came to the West and he took his shirt off in Congress and showed all the burn marks from the hot irons that they'd put into his flesh, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he wrote a book called Tortured for Christ, which is a hard read, but it's worth reading. And I had read the book. One day I was in the US at a, I used to be involved in Christian book publishing a little bit. And I was at a convention in the US where we were just wandering around, looking at all these different publishers and what books they were publishing. And occasionally these publishers would bring in an author and that author would sign books and so on. And I was coming down the aisle one day, and here I immediately thought, that's Richard Wurmbrand. And he was sitting in a wheelchair facing that way to the aisle. So I'm coming down the aisle this way, and he's sitting at right angles facing. And I couldn't believe that it was him. And I thought, I've got to check this is really him before I make a fool of myself. So I went by and looked at him, and then I looked up behind him to see who is this. And it was a publishing company called The Voice of the Martyrs, I think it was, which is still a thing today. So I thought, this really is Richard Wurmbrand. So I thought, I want to speak to this man. And I turned around and went back and knelt down next to him. He was about 80 years old, and he didn't look sad, but he looked very serious. He just sort of had this permanent furrow on his brow, and he looked like a person who had been really through a lot of suffering. And he's sitting in his wheelchair, and I just sort of knelt down next to him and I said, are you Richard Wurmbrand? And he said, yes, I am. I said, do you mind if I ask you a question? I said to him, how did you keep going in the prison in Romania when they were torturing you day after day after day after day and making you stand up against a wall with bright lights on and beating you if you fell over and, you know, all the things they did to him? This is horrific. And I said, how did you stand that every day when you never knew you'd ever get out? As far as you knew, you were in there for life and you'd be tortured and tortured and tortured. How did you keep going? And I really was expecting him to give me some profound answer from some Bible verse somewhere and explain it all to me. And this, you know, it would take him at least 5 minutes. He never opened his Bible. It didn't take 5 minutes. He just lifted up his hands like this from the wheelchair. And he said to me, we used to lift our hands every morning and sing, this is the day the Lord has made. We will be glad and rejoice in it. And I was just stunned. I couldn't believe it. It was like, this is a level of Christianity I never knew existed. This man is not bitter. This man is, he's not, He's like in another, he lives in another world to me. How is that even possible? And this is what Joseph was. He wasn't just carrying all his wounds and carrying all his baggage. We've all got wounds. We've all got baggage. That's life. But if you hang on to my parents were this and my church was that and my school was this and my neighbors were that and my cousins were awful, and you know, if you take that with you through life, you'll never be a Richard Wurmbrand, and you'll never be a Joseph, and you'll never be any use to anybody. Because if you believe, like Joseph believed, in the transcendent power of a sovereign God in your life, you will accept the good things and the bad things, and you'll discover it's just as bad to take offense as it is to give offense. And the spiritual way is to say, never mind all that. What's God doing? What am I supposed to learn in this? You see, Joseph had a dream when he was young. The sheaves were bowing down and the stars and the whatever. And he knew that God had promised one day, your brothers will bow down to you. And so when he was sold into Egypt, he still had that dream in his mind. And when he was betrayed by Potiphar's wife, he still had that dream in his mind. And when he was slammed in the jail, he woke up every morning thinking, oh, how long am I going to be in here? No, seemingly not. Seemingly, he woke up every morning thinking, the Lord has promised, and so I'll just wait. And the word of the Lord tried him and tested him. That word tried is the word used for the refining of metals. I know nothing about such things, but I'm told that if you put gold into a furnace and melt it down, it's basically coming out the other side pretty much identical to what it was, only it's purer. And so what God does is he puts us through the trials of life. Now, it's worth seeing the things that happen to us as trials. You know, if we see things happening to us as, I'm a victim, and they've done this to me, and I just can't forgive them, that's to look at it on that level, horizontal. But if we say, God allowed that awkward person into my life for a reason. God allowed, now I'm not saying we should accept, you know, if you're being abused in a terrible way, or you're being genuinely bullied to the point of insanity, I'm not saying just take it all. You need to get out of certain poisonous situations. I understand that. But on a relatively ordinary level, we're all going to face things that could potentially make us very bitter and very angry. But that's not the purpose. If we view it that way, and we say, no, Lord, what are you doing? What are you doing at this time in my life? And what you'll find is he's actually putting you through that to make you a better Christian. You say, well, can I not get to be a better Christian an easier way? Well, seemingly not. There are things that have to be, we have to get rid of them. And the Lord sometimes says, I'll get rid of them. And he brings us through processes. He puts us through fiery trials. Now, when he puts us into the furnace of trials, he keeps an eye on two things. He keeps an eye on the thermometer and he keeps an eye on the clock. So he knows what we can take, and he's promised he won't give us more than we can take. And he's also promised deliverance, whether that be in our lives or even at death, whatever, it'll eventually end in glory. So he keeps an eye on the clock. But when you're in the furnace, you don't know what the temperature is going to be. You don't know how long that clock's going to be ticking. So all you can do is wait. And that's what Joseph did. And we're going to learn a few things about Joseph's waiting as we talk about this together. I want to put my remarks now under three headings. I want to think of the places where Joseph waited. I want to think of the reasons why Joseph waited. And I want to look at the ways how Joseph waited. So let's just think of the places where he waited. Where did the clock start ticking on this waiting process? Well, the clock started ticking as soon as he had his dreams. Down in there in Hebron, he had these dreams, and now he's got a prophecy that's going to be fulfilled one day. His brothers are going to bow down to him. But he has no idea how long that's going to take. None whatsoever. It actually took 20 years. But he could never have imagined that. But the clock starts ticking. The first place he waited in was in the pit. His brothers were all, nearly all older than him, apart from Benjamin. They just chucked him in this pit. And there he is. Are they going to leave me here? How long am I going to be here? What if they just walk away? What's going to happen? He waited in the pit. He waited in Potiphar's house. We don't know how long he was in Potiphar's house before he got falsely accused by his wife, but he must have been there a reasonable amount of time because he came in charge of everything. Let's say weeks, months, maybe a year or two. We don't know. Then he waited in the prison. That must have been the hardest place of all to wait. You know, occasionally you hear these people that have been in prison for 50 years, falsely accused or something, and now they found the DNA of somebody else. But prisons nowadays are a lot better than they were in those days. And he's a Hebrew in an Egyptian prison in those lonely waiting years. Then there's a glimmer of hope. The butler's going to be released. Oh, please mention me to Pharaoh. He forgets. He waits 2 more years, 24 more months, 104 more weeks. Even when he got released from prison, it still wasn't the end. It wasn't the fulfillment of his dreams. There were 7 years of plenty. He never saw his brothers once in that time. And even when his brothers arrived, they still had to go away and come back. And it took a long time. But the only lesson I really want to draw from this business about where he waited here and here and here and here and here. Do you know what the Bible says? In all of these places, the Lord was with him. The Lord was with him. It specifically says in Potiphar's house, the Lord was with Joseph. And then he gets put in prison and it says specifically again, the Lord was with Joseph. Dear brother, dear sister, you can survive anything. You can come through anything. You can keep lifting your hands and saying, this is a day the Lord has made through anything, if you know the Lord is with you. When Jacob left home, God said to him, I will be with you wherever you go, and I will not leave you till I bring you back to this place, and I fulfilled all the promises I've given you. See, the brothers were up in the land. They were happy. They weren't in prison. They had no chains on. No one falsely accused them of adultery. They were happy. It was better at that moment in time to be in Egypt in prison, bound and falsely accused, than to be up in the land all happy and free with a guilty conscience, with a black deed that's running up behind you, because whatever you sow, you reap. I wonder where you are today. Waiting? Where are you waiting? In a difficult job, in a difficult family experience, in a difficult health crisis. Difficulties are innumerable in this world. I want just to encourage you this morning, wherever you are, if you're the only saved person in your entire family, remember this. As you wait for promises from the Lord and as you wait for the Lord to just make things clear, just remember this while you're waiting. Lord is with you. And he will never forsake you. And he will sustain you. And you will look back on those difficult days and think, the Lord was with me. And he has brought me through those experiences. And when we get to heaven, you know, we will look back and we'll say that in a real and a deep way. And we will regret if we lost years to bitterness and we lost years to anger and we lost years to victimhood and all that. So let us learn from the places where Joseph waited. Now think of why he waited. Why did God make him wait? So think of those brothers, Judah, Reuben, Issachar, Simeon. I mean, some of them are quite some characters. The most spiritual of them all is Joseph. And yet out of the 12, who does God make to wait? The godliest of all the 12. That doesn't seem fair, does it? If you were God and you got these 12 brothers and here's the godliest one, say, oh, that's fine, leave him. We don't need to do him. Now we need to sort these other ones out. But it's this godliest brother who is given this trying wait. So that's a good thing to bear in mind, dear brother, dear sister. Just because you come to all the meetings, read your Bible and pray and do all those things and try and live by the word of God doesn't mean you won't have any trials. It doesn't work that way. Some of the godliest people I know have been through the most horrific experiences where I think when I hear about them, I just can't explain why the Lord is doing that or allowing that. It just does not even register. Why is it that that other person that's sort of backsliding and living, and here's this dear sister, this dear brother, and they just seem to have wave after wave of problem till they're nearly buried under it all. Hebrews 12 tells us that everybody in God's family will undergo the training and the disciplining of the Lord. No one will escape. I'm 61. I don't know any Christian of my age who hasn't been through something pretty horrific. It just does. It just hits us all at some stage. But what are we going to do when that wave hits? What are we going to do? Are we going to do as the old Puritans used to say? Are we going to kiss the waves that throws us on the rock of ages? I mentioned Spurgeon last night. Spurgeon said that, I'm afraid that all the grace I've got out of my comfortable and easy times and happy hours might almost lie on a penny or a dime, maybe you call it. I'm not sure. Do you have pennies or dimes over here? He's saying, he looks back at his life and thinks, oh, those times when souls are getting saved and, you know, I was healthy, and he suffered from depression and ill health. And he looks back and thinks, everything that I gained from my happy times would fit on a penny. But the good that I've received from my sorrows and my pains and my griefs is altogether incalculable. I do not owe. What do I not owe to the hammer and the anvil, to the fire, to the file? Affliction is the best bit of furniture in my house. Now, you just Google when you get home, Spurgeon and depression. He suffered very badly from depression. He had to go to France to try and improve his health. But that's what he's saying. The trying of your faith produces what? Endurance and all the other fruits of the Spirit. So here's Joseph, and God is burning out of him and building into him what? The qualities and the character that he's going to need to be the ruler of all of Egypt. Now, he didn't know that he was going to be ruler of all Egypt. But when you become the president or the prime minister of an entire country, you are now in a situation where you need character, you need fortitude, you need wisdom, you need a whole bunch of things that you can't just get spoon-fed from somebody else. And all of this that he went through was eventually to fit him for doing something for the Lord. And that's sometimes, very often, the purpose of trials. The Lord puts us through things so that we then... You know, you take a little sapling, little tree that's coming up, and, you know, it gets this high, and then it gets this high, and then the winds come, and as it's sort of blown about when it's small, it starts to put its roots down, and then it gets a bit taller, and roots go down a bit further, and it gets a bit taller, and roots go down a bit further, and now it's a great big tree, and a hurricane comes through. Well, maybe not a hurricane, but a very strong wind comes through, and it blows against that tree. Does it fall over? Well, it could do. I understand it could do. But the point being, it's had lots of little winds and lots of little blows and lots of little storms. But all those little ones made it put its roots down and it was ready for the big one. And we're all going to have a big one. At some stage, we're all going to have a big trial, maybe 10 big trials. But the point of all the little trials along the way, the trials of our single-digit years, the trials of our teenage years, the trials of our 20s and 30s, the unmarried trials, the married trials, the children, all of that. Each time, if you put your roots down a little bit deeper, when the big trial comes, you're sort of ready for it. You've learned a little bit about God's ways with you. And in the meantime, all you've got to do is wait. Just wait on the Lord. We want overnight solutions, don't we? Have you ever been in a situation where the broadband goes down? What happened to the broadband? My phone's not working. if it spins a bit, you know, that little spinning thing on your phone? Oh, this wretched piece of junk. What's wrong with it? Well, just remember the old days when you had to go to the library and get volume 6 of the Encyclopedia Britannica to find out some fact. Now you're cross because you can't get it in less than a second. And that feeds into our life. We don't like waiting for things, waiting for the right person to marry. We want it now. We want to sort it. I want to get married before I'm X years old. We don't like to wait. And there's so many other things. But if you look through the Bible, you find Joseph is made to wait till he's older, 30 years old. Abraham and Sarah, they're made to wait for a child. Joshua and Caleb, they waited 40 years before they got into the land. Ruth is made to wait for a husband. David's made to wait to get on the throne. He's running around cave after cave and the man's chasing him. And yet he's already been anointed to be on the throne. Why does God make us wait? Because he has a reason. He's got plans. And the waiting time is not a time for mumbling and grumbling and groaning and complaining. It's a time to learn. It's a time to grow. It's a time to develop. One of the preachers I heard when I was young was called Tom Bentley. He probably came here years ago. He was from Northern Ireland. He was in an assembly called Ebenezer Gospel Hall. It used to be a huge assembly, 200 in fellowship, 700 in the Sunday school, had 13 double-decker buses to go on a Sunday school trip. Anyway, that was the good old days in Belfast during the war and all that. And he got very into his Bible and wanted to be a missionary. And he had a very clear, I've heard him tell this story, he got a very clear call from the Lord to serve the Lord as a missionary. So he went to the elders of the assembly and he said, I feel the Lord has called me and I would like to go into the Lord's work and I would like to go to China. And I don't know any of the men that interviewed him, but they seemed to be somewhat gruff. And they sort of said, oh, we'll get back to you. So weeks went by. And eventually, I think he might have asked them, is there any word on, you know, if he had any thoughts about it? And the answer he got was, we don't see it the way you see it. It's a tough old school in the old days. We don't see it the way you see it. Oh, well, now what do I do? So he waited and he waited. And over a period of 11 years, he went back to them 5 times. And every time was the same answer. Meanwhile, China closed because of the Cultural Revolution. And had he gone to China, he'd have been kicked out or killed. And when they finally said, we think you're ready and we're happy to commend you, he went to Malaysia. And he said, I wasn't in Malaysia a couple of weeks before I realized why the Lord kept me waiting 11 years. He met a barrage of difficulties. He ended up being the only white missionary left in Malaysia at one point because of the way things happened. And he looks back and says, yeah, that was a really difficult 11 years. But the difficulties and the disappointments and the waiting and the learning and all of that and the patiently not kicking against all this, these walls that are in the way, he now looks back and thinks, actually, that was a good thing. I'm not saying the way they handled him was correct. I'm not saying the way they spoke to him was correct. They may have been jealous of him. There could have been anything going on. But he was able to rise above that, eventually at least, and think, well, what if I'd have gone to China? What if I'd gone immediately to Malaysia and I was way, way, way younger, not as experienced, and I wouldn't have been... So he actually was able to reconcile with the fact that that waiting was for a reason. It's good when you can do that. It's a very practical thing to be able to look back in your life and think, thank God I didn't just get everything handed onto my plate, all the blessings that I could ever want when I was 19. The Lord sometimes keeps us waiting for a reason. Now, a few things about how he waited. So we've looked at where he waited and why he waited. Let's look at how he waited. He waited silently, number one. So we got that from Psalm 62. He waited silently. He waited only upon God. That's a good way to wait. Sometimes we wait very noisily, don't we? I don't mind waiting as long as everybody knows I'm waiting. And you're telling everybody, oh, you're very frustrated, and this isn't happening, and this isn't happening, and the appointment's not coming, and the operation's not sorted out, and you know, whatever. Wait silently. You know, we tend, when we're not getting what we want, we tend to thrash around, and we tend to pull a lot of levers and make a lot of moves and send a lot of emails. But Joseph waited silently. There was no email. There was no telephone. There was no way for him to go on social media and spew his whatever's in his head. He just waited silently. We don't know even what he was thinking. But he also waited patiently. That was Psalm 37. To wait patiently is incredibly difficult. You know, you think of David waiting to get on the throne. You talk about patience. He had javelins being thrown at him. He had Shimei cursing him. He had, you know, later he had Absalom rebelling against him. When I was a child, my mother had a big pot that she would put on the stove. It was aluminium, or aluminum, as you talk about over here. And she would put potatoes in there or whatever it was, and water, and then she had this big lid with a black plastic handle, and she would turn this lid on, and it was kind of cranked on, and there, in the middle of the pot and the top, there was this tiny little metal, I don't know what you call it, a little knob in the middle with a hole in it. It's called a pressure cooker. And you would put that on, and it would boil and boil and boil, and then eventually, the way the cooker told you it was ready was the steam would come out of this little pinhole and it would whistle. And you'd hear this, and it didn't matter where you were in the house, oh, quick, 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 and you'd run to the pressure cooker and you'd take it off the boil. You know, life can be like a pressure cooker sometimes. And the heat gets turned up and the steam starts building up. And the pressure is on. That's why the next verse in Psalm 37 says, cease from anger. So wait patiently, cease from anger, because we can get very angry and we can get very cross and we can lose our temper. Now, just because someone has lost their temper once, it doesn't mean you throw them under the bus and they can no longer be an overseer and they're dead and done for. No, you have to think about, so does this person lose their temper every week, every day, or is this like the first time in 30 years? There's probably a reason for it. And sometimes the pressures of life can get to such a point that you just blow. Now, that's normal. That's natural. It's not something to spend the rest of your life feeling guilty about. But this is what Joseph seemed not to do. He didn't seem to get angry. He didn't seem to get, we'll see in a minute, he didn't even try and get even. So he waited silently, he waited patiently, he waited faithfully. Remember what we read in Psalm 37, verse 34, wait on the Lord and keep his way. So in the middle of this waiting period, he's presented with this opportunity to commit sin, which he could have very easily done and probably got away with it. No one was looking. His dad was miles away. His brothers were miles away. He could have thought, well, what's the point in believing in God? I might as well enjoy a bit of sin while I'm here. You know, what could possibly go wrong? He didn't do that. Even though he was pushed to the limit by this lustful wife of Potiphar, he He did something extraordinary. He fled the scene. If you ever get a chance to read books by F.B. Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, jump at the chance, especially his biographies. He's written about 15 to 20 biographies, and they're all good. He writes about Joseph, and he says, if Joseph had yielded to Potiphar's wife, we should probably have never heard of him again. He would have been slain by the siren that has slain so many more strong men, and would have gone down to the dark chambers of death. No happy marriage, no wife, no child would have fallen to his lot. No honor, no usefulness, or vision for the dear faces of his kin would ever have enriched his life with abundant blessing. What a good thing he didn't yield. So while you're waiting, stay faithful to the Lord. Wait faithfully. Now, the last thing I want to say is he waited trustingly. So he waited silently, patiently, faithfully. He waited trustingly. And this is really the bottom line of everything, isn't it? He couldn't see the future. He didn't understand the present. He couldn't resolve the past. How did he keep going? He just trusted in the Lord. Psalm 105 says, God sent a man before them. He said, oh, it wasn't God, it was the Ishmaelites. It was Potiphar, it was the Egyptians, it was the brothers that sold him. No, God sent him. You say, well, how's that possible? Because that's what we're talking about in this message. We're talking about the fact that events happen in our lives, but God is over all. God sent Joseph. So do you think Joseph believed that? Yes, he did believe that. You say, well, how did he know that? Well, I'll tell you how we know that. We didn't read it, but if you keep going on to Genesis 50, which is very close to the end of the book of Genesis, you'll find that by this stage, the brothers have got down to Egypt. They've all hugged. They've made up. It's all great. And Jacob has come down to live there, and he lives for 17 years there. So we had Joseph for 17 years at the beginning here, Joseph for 17 years at the end, and then Jacob dies. And do you know what happened the moment Jacob died? The brothers, Simeon, Levi, Benjamin, all that lot, they all come running to Joseph and bow down on their face in front of him. And he's like, what's going on? Oh, please don't kill us. Please don't kill us. Please don't kill you. Oh, please don't kill us. You see, Joseph had reconciled himself to this whole thing properly and really. But they really couldn't hardly believe it. And they were thinking, no way. He's only being nice to us till Dad dies. And once Dad dies, he'll have us all hung, drawn and quartered. And Joseph looks at them and genuinely expresses his surprise. And he sort of says, am I in the place of God? In other words, even if I was, I'm not God. So the thought of me killing you for what you did, it's just not my job. That's up to God. If God wants to kill you, he can kill you. He can do it just like that. I know what you did, and I know you meant it. And I know you hated me to bits. And I know you were jealous, and I know you were envious. I know the whole story. But it's not my job to sort that out. It's not my job to make sure you pay. That's what God does. And God knows whether people need to pay or not. I think everybody needs to pay because I'm a human being with a fleshly, I've got the flesh within me. And of course, we think we know what everybody needs. But Joseph says, no, I'm not God. I don't know how God works in everybody's life. I know how he's worked in my life. And based on that, I wouldn't touch you at all. And he says to them these glorious words, as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to bring to pass as it is this day, to save much people alive. So what he's basically saying is, God allowed you to do what you did because he had bigger plans. You thought you were out for my destruction. God was actually out for your salvation. Because if I hadn't been sold into Egypt, there never would have been all this grain for you. You would have died, and if you had all died, there'd be no Jesus. And you and I wouldn't be saved. So Joseph is sent down to Egypt to keep the royal family alive. Oh, yes, he kept the whole world alive, but he kept the royal family alive. There's a man called Judah in that family, and his great, 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 great grandson was Jesus Christ. And so this family has to be preserved, and God went a long way round to preserve it. And Joseph was the man that he used. And these poor brothers hadn't got a clue. So he learnt, Joseph learnt to just leave it with God. He didn't sort of say, why is this happening to me? He didn't even say, why has God allowed it? His version of it was, God ordained it. And when you get to that place, you've really learned what it is to wait on the Lord. Now let's close with a word of prayer.